So welcome everyone. We're going to get started. I would ask you to turn your mics off so we can hear our expert and guest today. And then of course we will engage in regular discussions with our guests today. So we have the honor of having with us in this policy and practice seminar, Dr. Kingsley Moghalu. He's from Nigeria, he's a lawyer, he has been a journalist, a diplomat, and of course a financial sector specialist. He's an expert in policy making in a wide range of issues, as you will see, ranging from being one of the experts that did the revision of the UN dispute resolution framework, but also he was actually quite engaged and involved in Nigeria's central bank in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. And this is actually what Dr. Moghalu is going to be presenting to us today, the banking sector reform from 2009-2014, which is, of course, a result of the crisis and a response of the crisis. But Kingsley, really happy that you're here with us. It's Dr. Adnan Khan and myself giving you a warm welcome together with all of our students from the School of Public Policy at the London School of Economics. So the floor is yours. Welcome and looking forward to your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you, Adnan. Thank you, everyone who is here with us. Students of the School of Public Policy. My presentation will not be formal in the sense of slides and things like that. You will forgive me. You did not mention that I'm also a politician now. And that, it brings quite a lot of strains on one's time. I'm speaking to you from Oxford, where I am now an Oxford Martin Visiting Fellow at the University of Oxford, at the Oxford Martin School. So I'm going to be talking about, Nigeria's banking sector reforms as an example of public policy reform with consequential impact in a developing country, in a frontier economy or in an emerging market. However you want to look at it. So I'd like to start by saying, first of all, that you have to understand the background. Of course, we know the global financial crisis. The background is very well known, and it affected, in fact, even more developed countries and their financial sectors. It was the second round effects, actually, that affected Nigeria through its exposures in the oil sector and the capital markets in terms of foreign investors and portfolio investors. That's how the global financial crisis affected Nigeria. But you also have to look at a very interesting, unique feature of Nigeria in the 2000s. The 2000s were a period of a lot of reform in the Nigerian economy under the presidency of Olusegun Obasanjo. The central bank was not left out. There had been the first round of reforms because the country had about 89 banks, but many of them were really boutiques. They were just toys. They were not strong. Very few were strong of any systemic importance and able to actually perform the real functions of financial intermediation. Rather, many of them were just trading houses for foreign exchange, buccaneers. That's one. Two, a lot of the financial sector players in Nigeria at that time, who had become very wealthy, had an outsized political influence. So there were political economy issues where you have bank CEOs financing presidential campaigns and having open doors into the state house. Now that has implications for how banks are run. It has implications for the regulatory framework of the banks because it's being taken outside of the official central bank regulation into the era, into the realm of politics. So these are some of the unique things. And of course, it also meant that CEOs who were rich and powerful were not subject to effective corporate governance. And this had an implication, an effect for the savings of Nigerians in the banks and how these banks were managed and how they were run. So these are some of the things. First, the global picture. How did the global financial crisis affect the Nigerian banking sector? What were the channels? And then secondly, what were the unique factors inside Nigeria that made these reforms that we came with necessary? Now, the first thing I would say is that the ability to reform anything, you know, whether it's a company, a government, institution, or a financial system, it requires two things. The first is vision. The second is courage. You can have the vision, but if you don't have the courage to take on the vested interests, then you may not be able to reform, especially in developing economies that do not have strong institutions. So that's, you know, the background. Now, in 2009, I came to the central bank as a deputy governor. Sanusi Lamido Sanusi was appointed governor in June, and I joined him as one of the four deputy governors in November. Before then, most of my career had been in the United Nations, and for about a year before, running my own risk management and global strategy consulting firm in Geneva. So I was an accidental central banker. I didn't have a traditional career that led inside the bank or even in the banking system. But there were reasons why I was headhunted for this job. And I was headhunted specifically to lead the reforms. One of those were that my roles in previous lives involved risk management. And the global financial crisis and its, you know, impact showed the importance of risk management in the financial sector. So that was one thing that attracted the governor of the bank and the president of Nigeria to me to ask me to come home from Geneva, where I was at the time. Another reason was that I had a strong international profile. And that meant that I had not necessarily grown up professionally inside the Nigerian banking system or inside the Nigerian system, in fact. And this was seen as a necessary requirement for somebody who was going to have to take tough decisions and implement a very controversial program. You had to be independent of the system that you were going to regulate. If you had grown up in the banks with some of these bankers, they would have things on you, or they would have relationships with you that could possibly create issues for you in taking strong decisions. So these were some of the reasons why also I was specifically asked to come home, and I became a deputy governor, and I was assigned the Financial System Stability Directorate. And that directorate controlled the prudential regulation and supervision of the whole banking system and non-bank financial institutions as well. And also was responsible for development finance. So we had the banking supervision department, we had the financial policy and regulation department, we had the consumer protection department, we had the other financial institutions department, and we had the development finance department. So quite a very important slice of what the central bank was doing at the time. The reforms, you know, I also should say that for you to reform effectively in a place like Nigeria, you also have to have a global mindset. You have to have a sense of what other jurisdictions are doing, how far ahead of them you are, or how far ahead of you they are, and what are the unique differences or the unique patterns of different batches of jurisdictions, like in the Western world, like in Nigeria, like in Asia or China. The way central banking is done is sometimes a little bit different in different cultures. And then, of course, for reform, a top reformer must build a core team. That team is essential to drive reforms. And this is the context in which I was brought in, you know, in terms of building the kind of team that would lead the implementation of the reforms. In addition to being Deputy Governor for Financial System Stability, I was also a member of the Board of Directors of the Central Bank of Nigeria. I was also a member of the Monetary Policy Committee. So I also had economic policy functions as part of the MPC. So let me start with what made the reforms necessary? Why was it necessary? There were five main factors that led to the banking sector reforms in Nigeria, led ultimately by the governor, Sanusi Lamido Sanusi, and with me as his deputy responsible for the implementation of those reforms. And I think the first of those five factors was that a few years earlier, the central bank had consolidated the 89 banks that existed into 24 banks. They did this by moving up the capital requirement from 2 billion naira to basically that was about maybe $20 million and moved it up to 25 billion naira, which was about $200 million required as capital for a bank to be set up. So of course, many banks could not meet this very steep hike in capital requirements. And of course, there had to be a consolidation. Banks had to go into marriages, sometimes shotgun marriages of the type that you can easily contract in maybe Las Vegas or something. You know, and that had implications. You know, people getting married without knowing each other, and so on and so forth. So there were some misfits in the consolidation. Now, the banks had 18 months to meet these capital requirements, which many people also felt was also a bit of a short period of time. So this created a lot of complications, including it wasn't very clear whether the capital that was required was shareholders' funds or paid up capital. And this led to a phenomenon that we call bubble capital. Some banks trying to create the impression they had the 25 billion, but in fact, they really didn't have it. So this was one very important backdrop, you know, of the consolidation of banks. Now, also another problem was that asking every bank to have the same capital requirement was seen as a bit, you know, one size fits all. And this was viewed by some critics as a bit of an unnatural situation where every bank in a country has to have the same type of capital. And some argued that there should be different levels of capital for different sizes of banks. So, but that's the import of the consolidation. The second major thing was the global financial crisis. The impact of the global financial crisis, as I had said, on Nigeria was not really direct because financial institutions in Nigeria at the time were not fully integrated into the global financial architecture. But it came indirectly through what I call second round effects. One, the price of oil. Oil price was at a very high place at $147 a barrel at some point in 2008. And almost overnight, it crashed to $47 a barrel. Now, Nigeria is a monoproduct economy. It relies on crude oil and crude oil sales for over 90% of its foreign exchange earnings. So you can imagine the impact of this oil price crash on the financial system. The governments had problems now. They had to go into deficits. The banks, many of the banks had been lending to oil and gas companies. And so of course their loans went bad. Some of the banks were also lending to governments because at that time, governments could borrow from commercial banks. We stopped that. But at that time, they could borrow from commercial banks. And so you know, the many of the bank's loans to both governments and oil and gas companies really went bad. And this was a big stress for many of the banks, of the 25 banks now in existence, or 24 banks. Another way was through the stock market. Nigeria's stock market was seen as one of the very high performers because a lot of foreign investment, portfolio foreign investment, was coming into the country. And so the stock market, everybody was buying shares in Nigeria around 2005, 2006, 2007. And it seemed as if share prices had nowhere else to go but up. There wasn't enough investor education that whatever goes up can come down. Or that investments in the stock markets were risk, you know. So banks, many banks, had been lending money to Nigerians for what we call margin lending. They had been lending money to Nigerians to buy shares. So when the share prices went down, as the foreign investors, portfolio investors, withdrew about $15 billion from the Nigerian capital markets within a very short time, the banks who had been lending to investors on the stock market were holding the short end of the stick. So between the oil price and the stock market, there was a huge negative impact on the Nigerian economy and the Nigerian banking sector specifically. With the sharp fall of oil prices, Nigeria's external reserves were affected. And so the central bank had to spend a lot of money trying to shore up the value of the country's currency. Then the third thing was that there was weak corporate governance and risk management. I told you in the beginning that a lot of Nigerian bankers have become politically powerful. Now, if a banker is a friend of the president, a supervising officer in the central bank may not be very effective in trying to get that banker to behave well. So, and many of them, corporate governance was weak because the whole idea of a supervisory board supervising bank CEOs was turned on its head, and you had the CEO, you know, selecting people to come into the board to basically rubber stamp his decisions. And so the boards of directors were not strong. And this allowed a lot of bank CEOs, swashbuckling bankers, to do whatever they liked, essentially, and get away with it. And of course, there was a very weak risk management culture. A lot of banks had risk management models that were fashionable and faddish, but there wasn't a culture of risk management. It's one thing to have a model, a risk management model. It's another thing to have a culture of managing risk, which I believe is far more important than faddish, you know, technology or models. Which of course failed as it did in the Western world to predict the crisis. Very few people in the Western world were able to predict the crisis. In fact, nobody, other than one or two, maybe Rubini, the economist Rubini, I think was one of them, and one or two others. I think the former governor of the Reserve Bank of India as well. I forget his name. So coming out of the consolidation, focused on growth and expansion, in the world, Nigerian banks went global, you know, but they skipped the financial intermediation path locally and became very globally ambitious, setting up banks in African countries, in America, in Europe, and so on. So this was the background to the crash. There was another factor, which was the weakness in the regulatory environment. The central bank had been so focused on the consolidation and making it happen that they took their eye off the ball of regulation and supervision. At least this was what it looked like to any independent observer of the sector at the time. So this is the background to in terms of why the reforms had to happen. Now, let me speak about the principles that drove the reforms. The first principle was we had to restore trust in banking. Trust is the backbone of banking. You put your money in a bank with the expectation that when you go there, you will get it when you demand for it. And that's why you put your money in a bank rather than under your pillow. So trust is a very important foundation in the banking industry. and we were determined to restore this trust, especially against the background that about 20 years earlier, there had been a banking crisis also in Nigeria when many banks failed. And so a lot of depositors lost their money. Some had strokes, some had hypertension. People were still very scarred about that incident. So we were very sensitive to the matter of trust in the banking system. We also, secondly, we wanted to emphasize financial stability. You know, we had to emphasize systemic risk and the interconnectedness that existed in the banking system. And so we had to identified certain banks as systemically important. Because out of the 24 banks that existed before these reforms, about 8 or 9 or maybe 10 had become wobbly as a result of all these factors, the global financial crisis, weak risk management. So it wasn't all the banks, but about a third of the banks. But some of those banks were systemically important banks. The third principle we had was that no bank would fail. We decided ab initio that there will be no bank failures, you know, and that no depositor was going to lose a dime. And then we had to emphasize the governance and risk management of banks. That was also another principle that guided us. We had to show banks and bankers that the era of swashbuckling indiscipline and arrogance was over. And if you're handling other people's money, you've got to govern your institution well, you've got to manage your risk exposures. So this was very important for us. And then five, we had to come up with a new banking model. Not every bank must have $200 million of capital to start. There could be big banks, there could be small banks, there could be medium-sized banks. That's much more economically sensible. And so this was our belief. So we categorized banks into three types. There were the global banks that had subsidiaries in various countries around the world. There were the national banks, and then there were regional banks, you know, smaller banks. And we required different levels of capital for each one. And then also, of course, we were the first central bank to establish accountability in response to the global crisis. I think it was Iceland that came later, but the Central Bank of Nigeria was the first. You know, we fired several bank CEOs, but we also sent some of them to jail. We had them prosecuted for financial crimes and some were convicted. This was unheard of. And even in the West, we would go to international conferences and people would tell me, Kingsley, I remember the central bank of the governor of this Irish central bank telling me at a meeting, teach us, Kingsley, you know, how do we put bankers in jail? There are lots of them in London that should be cooling their heels behind bars, but they're sipping champagne in various cocktail parties. We don't like this. How were you able to do it in Nigeria? So accountability was an important principle. And then another principle was central bank independence. You know, we relied heavily on the principle of central bank independence to be able to do the reforms, because as you can imagine, there were many politically vested interests that were against the reforms we were coming up with. And so they were trying to influence the central bank not to hold people accountable, not to raise the capital requirements in certain types of banks, but we insisted, based on the Central Bank Act of 2007, the bank an independent institution. And then we used strategy. My term of office was 5 years. The term of office of all the governors, the governor and the four deputy governors, was 5 years. So using the governor's 5 years as the template, we knew that between 2009 and 2014, we had a number of things that we had to accomplish. And we had a strategy developed professionally with the help of strategy advisors and strategy consultant firms. And we had strategy management of those strategies and their execution. So this is the background. Now, what exactly were the reforms we did? The first was what I call a decisive intervention. These banks, about 8, 9, 10 banks, were struggling. They had no liquidity. We had done a forensic examination of many of the banks and concluded that some of them were really, really wobbly. And if action was not taken, they would collapse. So the first thing was for the central bank to inject about $4 billion of liquidity into the banking system. So we lent about 8, 9 banks money, which they had to pay back to the central bank on commercial terms, to keep them as going concerns. This was the first thing we did. But along with that came what some people would call a Friday massacre, where the governor of the bank, Sanusi at the time, invited about 5 bank CEOs to a meeting and handed them dismissal letters, because the central bank, under the act, the central bank can remove a bank CEO, the central bank governor, for good cause. And so, you know, based on the reports that the bank, central bank had, some of these CEOs had been actually committing crimes and stealing depositors' funds. Some of them would create companies and pretend to be lending those companies money, but those companies belonged to them. So they were simply siphoning money from the banks into their own companies and spiriting those monies away. So the governor sacked 5 CEOs and later sacked another 3. So there were 8 bank CEOs fired. And then there was this massive injection of liquidity into the banks. We also created an asset management corporation, which was established to absorb toxic assets, you know, from the weak banks, and give them a clean balance sheet, and enabling them to start lending, you know, again. So we also empowered AMCON to be able to make recoveries and to recapitalize failing banks. So we got this idea from Malaysia, where we visited and we saw how they had handled their own bank crisis. We also looked at Sweden and a few other countries. Ireland later set up something like that, and they looked at our own model in Nigeria. So this was part of establishing financial stability, an asset management corporation approach. We improved corporate governance. We made the maximum tenure for CEOs to be 10 years. So you cannot be a CEO of a Nigerian bank for more than 10 years. We did this again with the culture, local culture in mind, where CEOs had become uncontrollable. And they ran the banks as if they owned it personally. And sometimes they had very large shareholdings. And this has an implication for corporate governance, because the banking sector is a very special sector, and it's far more regulated than many other kinds of businesses. So we didn't want CEOs that were emperors. So 2 terms, 5 years each, that's it. You had to go. We abolished universal banking. Universal banking is a practice where a bank could be a financial supermarket. The bank could be involved in pensions, they could be involved in stockbroking, they could be involved in traditional banking. And so, you know, they were trading on their own account. And this was not good. And we had to stop it. You know, we had to ring fence depositors' funds by abolishing universal banking. Again, this was also done in the UK. I can't remember whether we did it before them or they did it after us. I'm not sure. Like I said, we established a new banking model. We improved the Basel II and III capital requirements, introduced them into the banking sector. We introduced a holding company model, you know, to transition from core banking into financial holding companies as a some sort of compensation for having, you know, stopped universal banking. And then we did a lot of reforms in the payment system. For those who follow the Nigerian banking sector, then you would know that fintech is one of the biggest growing sectors in the Nigerian economy. So we reformed the payment system by bringing in electronic banking. We brought in the point of sale. We introduced a bank verification number, BVN, a unique identifier, which made payments easier and more secure. So these were some of the reforms that we did. What was the impact of our reform? One, For one, the stability and confidence, you know, in the Nigerian banking system and economy was restored by the Central Bank of Nigeria's reforms. Many people felt we were decisive, we were strong, even if sometimes controversial, but ultimately people had confidence in the banks that they would not fail and their money was safe. So that trust, confidence, we achieved the restoration of it. The second major impact was that foreign investment into Nigeria increased massively between 2010 and 2014, because investors had confidence in the regulatory environment that we established. And they felt this was an economy, and it's a big economy. Nigeria is Africa's largest economy. South Africa comes second, at least in terms of GDP. Now, thirdly, I talked about the growth of fintech. That was one of the impacts of our reforms. Fintech has grown exponentially in Nigeria, and there are many foreign players and local players in the fintech industry in Nigeria. Then, of course, global recognition. Our reforms were ahead of several more mature global central banking jurisdictions. And this attracted recognition and respect from peer central banks and central bankers. And it was very good. This was a great story coming out of the developing world. You know, a story of reform, a story of courage, a story of doing the right things at the right time and doing it very professionally. So it really brought a lot of recognition to our central bank. But no reform is perfect. No reform is perfect. And our reforms were also criticized by some analysts, some independent analysts, and some vested interests naturally. The first criticism that we got massively was from the shareholders of the banks that had failed because they lost their shirt. We said no depositor will lose a kobo. But in the process of recapitalizing banks whose shareholders' funds had gone below zero, they were wiped out. They lost their shirt. They didn't like it. And they complained bitterly, you know. And this stemmed from what we considered a fundamental misunderstanding about the nature of banks. 70 to 80% of the money that banks do business with is depositors' funds. It's not shareholders' funds. So we prioritize the depositor first, creditors second, shareholders last, third and last. That was the way we did the reform. And so many depositors lost their investments. And this was, of course, something that made them very unhappy. And they were very critical of the central bank. But we had to explain that our first job was to save the depositors, then make sure that the creditors, we guaranteed all loans to the banks from creditors, that they would be repaid. Because if we didn't, you know, confidence in investing in Nigeria would crash, and that would be very terrible. But the investors, some of them, who, because first of all, they were shareholders, but they were not doing their job at shareholders' meetings. They would come and be celebrating some of these CEOs who were crooks instead of holding them accountable. Now you want the central bank to guarantee you your money, but you couldn't take corporate governance measures to safeguard your investment in the banks. So this was, of course, a sore point. The second, somebody said that our reforms were done, quote unquote, as the spirit leads, because we were churning out reform measures every week, practically every other day. And some people said, is there a grand strategy behind these reforms? Or do we just wake up in the morning and as the spirit leads us, we make a new rule? So you had those kinds of criticisms, but they were not grounded. It's just that given the sheer quantum of work we had to do. My 5 years at the central bank were 5 years of 14-hour work days straight. I didn't realize how exhausted I was until I finished my tenure at the bank. And then I was appointed a professor of international business and public policy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. So it was when I left the bank that I realized how exhausted I was. 5 years of reform work, 14-hour work days. really left us very drained. The third criticism was criticism of the governor of the bank. And that was that, oh, he had personal vendettas against, just 1 second, just hold on.
I'm making a presentation at the London School of Economics. I'll be done. That's why I said five. But I'll be done by 7:30. So we can look at 7:38. Yeah, 7:38 UK time. Okay, I will do that. Okay, all right. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry about that. So the central bank governor, Sanusi, had been a CEO of a commercial bank before he was appointed as the governor, but he was a risk management expert. So some of the CEOs who were fired, or some who were brought under discipline or held accountable, were spreading the word that he was on a vendetta against his former competitors in the banking sector. Again, this was a groundless accusation, because everybody who had been disciplined or held accountable had actually done something wrong. Then there was the question, number four, the question of moral hazard. We said that no bank would fail. We said no depositor would lose their funds. But the interesting thing is that this has remained the attitude or the official policy posture of the Nigerian banking system up till now. What does this mean? Does this mean that every bank CEO knows at the back of his mind that no matter what, the central bank will come to the rescue? Does this create some sort of moral hazard? I personally think this is an important matter and a valid issue to look at. I felt that although at that particular time, the posture that no bank would fail was the right one, but we cannot make that permanent policy. What we should do is to ask banks to develop living wills, what we call living wills. In case they collapse, we can give them a peaceful burial and save the depositors somehow, make them good, but the bank itself could be allowed to fail. Because otherwise, with AMCON, and then with the bank's central bank's own posture itself, and with AMCON still existing and continuing to do its work, it's kind of a moral hazard, because yeah, everybody knows that come what may, central bank is there, come what may, AMCON is there, you know. So the stabilization of the financial sector could now have unintended consequences, you know. So this was one of the criticisms. And then I think perhaps the final criticism was that we were so busy, you know, that we were not able to set up something that I had advocated, which was a philosophy of banking. You know, in the whole question of whether Nigeria's economy is really a financialized economy, but how much are the banks contributing to the growth of the real economy? The financialization that took place in the Western world on Wall Street, which was, of course, horrendous. But fortunately for America and all the developed countries, they already had great economies. So if financialization, you know, became the norm, its consequences were not as disastrous as they were for an economy that was still growing and had not yet actually been properly built to jump into financialization without developing a strong real economy. I think called for a philosophical examination of Nigerian banking by the central bank. We didn't have time to do this, you know, because it was just managing one crisis after the other. So, but, you know, in conclusion, our reforms were a template, in my view, of transformative leadership in a developing economy or in a frontier economy. I think I'm personally proud to have played a very important part in those reforms. And the fact that I came from outside actually helped me a lot, you know. So I I didn't know any of the CEOs personally. And so I think it gave me confidence to do my work without, and they knew, because they didn't know me, they had to be very careful too. There was no way to approach me as a regulator on the basis of friendship or old school boy and old school ties and the banking sector. So, you know, but it was a huge transformation. And Nigeria's banking sector has by and large remained stable till today, not without challenges. But yes, it has broadly remained stable. But the fundamental problems of the economy remain. And that is that the economy is not diversified. This is, of course, outside of the realm of the central bank. But also another important problem is that the currency has had a lot of problems. The Naira has suffered a lot of devaluation, a lot of fall in its value because of the economy's mono tendencies, you know, to depend only on the oil price. And so, you know, the Naira has been massively devalued from the time we were there. And many people are not happy. Now, the central bank tends to try to defend the value of the Naira by injecting foreign exchange into the forex markets. But this is a subsidy on the Naira. And so basically you're subsidizing an import dependent economy. Whereas if you let the Naira float, perhaps there will be a new incentive for exports that would end foreign exchange into the current, into the country. But there's a fear of the political risk of massive further devaluations of the Naira. And I think this has prevented the central bank from floating the Naira. So this is where we are. This is a summary of what we did and why we did it and how we did.
Thank you so much, Kingsley, for such an insightful presentation. Definitely lots of challenges. Important to understand the context, how the reforms were thought of and then implemented. And now, of course, as you said, no reform is perfect, and challenges old and new are there, no? So I have some questions, and I will start by asking you, when you talked about the consolidation, which I found impressive, 89 to 24 banks, no? And the reason behind that was the change in the capital requirement that you asked for banks in that time. Why was a threshold established, and why was not a risk-based capital requirement established at that time? Because of course, consolidation at some point is good, but consolidation does not necessarily address risks, and having less banks does not mean that they are less exposed to risk. So that was my first question. And then the second part is more related to the injection of liquidity. And the injection of liquidity you mentioned was made to 9 banks. My question was, how did that play over time? Because sometimes it's not only lending the lender, no, as the monetary authority, but rather access to finance, and rather risk assessment of individuals, risk assessment of SMEs, not having the possibility of a collateral, and even financial education and financial inclusion. So how did that play out both in terms of how the capital requirement decision was made, and in the second part, how has the lending the lender policy in terms of the monetary injection of resources has played out over time? So those are my questions, and perhaps after me I will ask Adnan if he has some other questions, and then we'll leave students make their own questions as well. Thank you, Kingsley, again.
Great, Vanessa. Thank you. Those are very good questions. You know, the consolidation was done by the previous governor of the central bank before Sanusi, Charles Soludo. So it wasn't done by us. Charles Soludo had a vision of Nigerian banks becoming big global players. He had a vision of Nigerian banks having enough capital to be able to intermediate in the financial system. And he felt that all these toy banks scattered all over the place, just basically foreign exchange trading firms, you know, because that was giving them profits, but they were not really doing banking. So he felt this was not going to work. Now, the jacking up of the capital requirement from 2 billion naira to 25 billion naira was a bit arbitrary. But you are right that there was not really a Basel 2 or 3, you know, capital, risk-based capital approach. We were the ones who introduced Basel 2 into the banking system. So again, this was one of the comments that were made because the central bank governor at the time, Soludo, was a great economist. But many people felt that he wasn't very interested in banking, but he was interested in the economy. So Sanusi, on the other hand, was a banker and a risk manager at that. So you see how the backgrounds of the two different governors influenced their approach to reform. You know, Sanusi came at reform from a risk management perspective, as Soludo came at his reform from an economic perspective, you know. So this is what happened. And I think this is what influenced those kinds of policy choices. But in the process of trying to consolidate, you know, the supervision of the process of consolidation seemed to have become a bit lax. And it was as if the central bank was working to an answer in order to show that the consolidation had been successful. And some of the hanky-panky that was going on in the process was overlooked, it appeared, you know, and some people were critical of this. So now regarding the liquidity injection, as you know, the central bank, you know, is in most countries is the banker of last resort. And in Nigeria, that's exactly the case. And it was in that role that the central bank injected the liquidity. It was such a controversial decision because some of our politicians who were not very educated on the principles of central banking were criticizing the central bank. And the central bank was saying, this is not an appropriation. It's not a fiscal appropriation. It's us acting as bankers of the last resort in the banking system. So we cannot come to the national, the parliament for their approval because that would be to compromise the independence of the bank. Now, from a commercial point of view, the bailout actually worked out very well because many of those banks became stabilized over the next 2-3 years. And that injection was repaid to the central bank with interest. No default occurred on that injection. So it was a commercially sound investment by the central bank. And we got all the money back, no exceptions. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kingsley. Adnan, please.
Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you, Kingsley, for a very exciting talk, very interesting talk. You have a lot of experience of different worlds, both in the academic world, international system, but also you came back to Nigeria in a difficult environment and tried to make reforms at a very difficult time.
Yeah.
And so my question is more about like, our students are also in a similar stage. We have some years of experience. They will be going back to their context and trying to reinsert themselves into a policy space, which is often in many countries very contested, where serving alone is not easy, yet alone trying to make reforms. So what lessons do you draw from your experience? And you obviously have worked in a very, very difficult country, Nigeria. As the Hollywood says, it's no country for old men. In fact, I'm looking into the Economist for next week, which just came out a few minutes ago. And the story on Nigeria is titled The Crime Scene at the Heart of Africa.
Wow.
So it's a difficult country, like many other countries.
Yes, absolutely.
And trying to make reform at a very difficult country is a very challenging and chastening experience, as you yourself mentioned. What lessons would you draw from your successes, but also your failures in terms like, which would be valuable for our students in terms of what to do, what not to do, how to position themselves?
Yeah. I mean, one of the lessons I would say that I learned personally is that very difficult reforms require political leadership support in order to be successful. One of the reasons why our reforms succeeded is that the president at the time, Umaru Yar'Adua, who later passed on, sadly, after about 2.5 years or 3 years. But he gave the governor carte blanche to do whatever needed to be done, you know, to stabilize the banking system. So political support for reforms is necessary. Otherwise, the reforms wobble and dissolve in controversies, and they don't succeed at the end of the day. Because every reform challenges vested interests. So it cannot succeed if some authority that is higher than the vested interests is not backing the reforms. So this is number one. And this is one of the reasons why, for example, I've been a candidate for the Nigerian presidency, because it was the lesson I learned that in the central bank, although we succeeded in our reforms, partly because we had political support, but also because the central bank's independence was etched in stone, and we had the courage to defend that independence. But broadly, in terms of the economy, especially in the fiscal economy, the trade and all these other areas, a country cannot make economic progress beyond the competence or incompetence of its political leadership. So there is no, you know, Nigeria is not, I'm trying to make Nigeria Italy, where Mario Draghi is now the prime minister, and they brought him in because he has particular skills and so on. But it's a mature environment. In Nigeria, the politicians who are holding the economy at the juggler, they don't want any infusion of technocratic political leadership. They don't want it. They resist it, you know? So the political culture and process of every country creates the context for whether reforms can happen or not. And you need political support at the top of the food chain for reforms to be successful. In terms of individuals who are going into policy positions, I would say, like, if you have an MPP from LSE, School of Public Policy, and you go back into your central bank or into your Ministry of Finance, or when you frame a policy recommendation, don't focus on the criticism, on a criticism of the status quo. I think you should focus on the shared benefits of reform. So you move the mind of even the people with the vested interests to see how they could also possibly benefit from a new way of doing things. So this is also, it's just about diplomacy in presenting reform proposals and making the case for them. You know, you have to mention what the country is losing from the current status quo, but quickly shift to the value addition of the reforms. That makes it easier to manufacture consensus, political consensus around reforms. That's what I would say to your students.
Thank you, Kingsley. Back to you, Vanessa. Time to maybe open up to students.
Thank you, Adnan. Yes, we have Siad, then Tatiana, then Isian, then Mohammed. So Siad, please, go ahead.
Thanks, Vanessa. Thank you, Your Excellency. This is very valuable information. My name is Ziad, I'm from Jordan. I wanted to ask you or get your insight on, first of all, broadly, how would you define the independence of a central bank from the government? You touched a bit upon that in the previous answer. And to go a bit more specifically in the case of Nigeria, would you consider the Central Bank of Nigeria completely independent in decision-making, especially in times of crisis? So in theory, when economy is doing good, et cetera, one can have the flexibility to define policies separate from other government bodies. But in a time of crisis that you mentioned, given that Nigeria is dependent on the oil price, at least for the recent past, and with what's happening with currency value, funds outflow, et cetera.
Thank you, Ziad. Very, very good question. Let me answer practically. Conceptually, central bank independence became the norm, I think, in the 70s, and continued for a very long time. In recent years, though, I must say that it looks as if it's under attack in many, many jurisdictions. because there is the constant tension, and I've written an article about this in the Central Banking Journal, there is this tension between the democratic legitimacy of an elected political government and the idea that an institution that is not itself sovereign can be independent totally of the sovereign, whom the voters have put into place. But the reason central bank independence exists is ultimately for the interest of the economy as a whole. What we call, it's about the time horizon factor, that politicians are looking at the next election and what's popular, what gets them elected. If lower interest rates can get them elected, they would want lower interest rates. But the central banker knows that there is inflation, and that if you don't spike up the interest rates to control the money supply, the effect on the economy will be quite destabilizing. So this is why we have central bank independence. And it is best if it is very clearly statutorily provided for. Now, when we were at the bank under the governorship of Sanusi, and I was a deputy governor, we acted consistently as an independent central bank. But after the era of Sanusi and myself, the bank has not, in practice, acted as an independent central bank. For one, the government that came to power in 2015, headed by President Buhari, who used to be a military dictator decades ago, but later came back as an elected president, does not have the mindset of independent institutions. So the central bank seems to have come quite a bit under the sway of the presidency. Because, for example, when the oil prices crashed in 2014, in 2015, President Buhari came, he wanted fixed interest rates, fixed exchange rates. And he indicated to the central bank that this is what he wanted because he doesn't have the economic understanding. And the central bank went along with this, and this caused a recession in Nigeria. So in recent years, I would not say the Nigerian central bank has shown itself as an exemplar of central bank independence. We did. But it also had its costs. One of the costs it had was that the governor at the time, Sanusi, you see, it's one thing to be independent. It's another thing to flaunt your independence in the face of politicians. They don't like it. Politicians who are elected don't like to think anybody is beyond their reach. So I would advise Sanusi then, let's act to protect our independence, but let's not flaunt it in the face of the government. And they would sneeringly call us when we went for meetings in the presidency, the Republic of the Central Bank, which is a very disapproving kind of faint and damning praise. And I remember the chief of staff of the president, when he wanted me to do something, I was acting governor. He wanted me to do something that just wasn't a great idea. And I said, we can't do it for so-and-so reason. And he says, Kingsley, you are always reminding me of your rules and regulations. I want to tell you that we too here have rules and regulations. And one day you may need our help and you will find out. We will read you our rules and regulations too. And ultimately what happened was that Sanusi was removed from office by the president in early 2014 because there was a feeling that he had become a political challenger of the government, not just an independent central bank governor. So they found a way. The Central Bank Act says you cannot remove the governor except with a vote of 2/3 of the Senate. But what they did was to find a very smart legal way to do it. They suspended him 3 months to the end of his tenure, or 4 months. That's, what does that mean? You ain't coming back, So they found a very clever way to do it. And what happened was that after Sanusi, they swore that the central bank will not be headed by, these independent central bank types of people. It's gonna be our guys who will head the bank. And this is what has led to further and further problems in the management of the Nigerian economy. So there are political aspects of central bank independence, there are economic dimensions of it, especially in a country without a culture of strong institutions. Even in the United States, President Trump had problems with Jay Powell, whom he appointed, but Trump, again, does not believe in the independence of any institution. So he, you know, in that sense, he was actually far more African than some African dictators. Interfered everywhere, no institution was safe. And he tried it on the central bank governor, and the governor had to, the chairman of the Federal Reserve had to push back, yeah, on Trump, you know. So yeah, it's about the mindset of the political leader. He or she has to understand why a central bank needs to be independent and respected. Yeah. Now the governor would go and give the president a briefing once every 3 months, naturally. You know, just here's what's happening, why, here are some decisions. And so that's normal. You have to do that. You know, yeah, but so yeah, that's my experience with central bank independence. I would say the situation is not very good today.
Thank you. That's very valuable. Emerging markets are always exciting.
Exactly. I mean, we saw it in Turkey. In Turkey, yeah, you know, we've seen the war of central. We saw it in Hungary. You know, in several jurisdictions, it's always a battle. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kingsley, and indeed fascinating. As you were answering the question posed by Ziad, I was thinking how similar the actual context of Mexico is right now in that regard, and the challenge to independent and technical institutions. But I'll pass on the word to Tatiana. Please, Tatiana.
Thank you very much. That was extremely interesting. So thank you for that. And it prompted me two questions. So the first one is about trust. You mentioned I'm French Lebanese.
Oh, okay.
And I'm an MPA student.
Oh, great.
My first question is about trust. You mentioned how trust was important, and you said that for you it was also an asset to be to not know the CEOs of the banks when you arrived. And I was curious to know, how did you manage to still create a relationship with them in order for them to follow your policies? So how did you build this trust without crossing that line? So that's my first question.
Okay.
And my second question is about the process of reform itself. So it's not an easy journey, I suppose. And I was wondering, did you at some point face any resistance? And if yes, from who? And did you have to go back to your policy and review it? And if yes, what was the process? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tatiana. Very good. Very good questions. One on trust. As a leader, one of the things I've found is that a great way to lead is to develop trust. But how do you develop trust exactly? You do it in three ways. You develop trust by very clear communication, and even better when it's persuasive, when it calls to the higher angels or calls on the higher angels of our natures. You develop trust when you are fair and seem to be fair to all. And you develop trust when you are seen to be transparent, no hidden agendas. If that becomes the perception, then you've gained trust. And whatever decisions you take, most people know you're taking it on an objective basis, not on a subjective basis. So that's how I dealt with the issue. Frankly, appropriately reserved in my dealings with the bank CEOs, you know. So, but within a short time, they were able to trust me and to respect me, even though I wasn't originally from the industry. It also helped that, you know, within 3 months, I was the master of my brief, and I have thought deeper about the brief than people who have been in the industry for life. And so when you're guiding decision-making or consensus building, and you're showing deep insight, it also brings respect and trust. Yeah, so I think these are some of the factors. On the matter of resistance, yes, we had some initial resistance to the reforms because there were attempts to use the presidency. After the first president, Yar'Adua, died, and President Jonathan became the president, some of the people who were brought under accountability were from the part of the country of President Jonathan. And we could feel there was pressure on him to rein in the central bank. But the governor fiercely resisted those attempts. And so, yes, but there were issues also with the management, how the governor managed that delicate balance between independence and, you know, a perception of how you respect the elected authorities, you know. So another thing I recommend in emerging markets and developing countries is that economics education is very important for the population and for policymakers. You'll be surprised in some countries that people who are policymakers do not have enough understanding about economics, about the economy, for them to be able to perceive decisions taken by a central bank, for example. You know, so I felt we never had enough time to do this, but I felt that the central bank needed to have periodic seminars with the permanent secretaries, with the ministers on the economy and how we saw it and why we were taking the decisions we were taking. And in a sense, give forward guidance, you know, not just to the markets, but to the government. Yeah, so these were some of my experiences.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And now it's Isian's turn, please.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Isian. I'm an MPP student, and I'm also an officer at the Central Bank of Malaysia. So I very much enjoyed your talk today. You talked a bit about central bank independence. My question is a little bit more general. In the recent years, we've had a lot of challenges with developments related to, you know, digitalization and climate change. I was just wondering what you thought about the role of the central bank and whether there's a boundary to what the central bank should or can do, or whether it should just be, you know, sticking to its usual mandates. I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Okay, thank you. That's a very good question. You talked about climate change, right? Yeah, okay.
Climate change and digitalization, but, you know, just developments in general.
Yeah, new frontiers. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. First of all, allow me a little bit of time to rhapsodize about my meetings and visits to Malaysia. I don't know if you were in the central bank then, when Governor Zeti, Actor Aziz, was your governor. And very good friend of mine, a good friend of Sanusi, she was very helpful in terms of advising us on how to launch the reforms when we visited the Bank Negara in late 2009. So she's a great lady, and your current governor Muhammad bin Muhammad, I think, is he still there?
He's actually been replaced already. He's already been replaced. It's currently Governor Shamsia.
Oh, I see. Okay, mm-hmm. I see. Okay, interesting. So, but you know, we had a lot of dealings with Bank Negara, and I think it's a model developing country or emerging market central bank, Bank Negara. I got to tell you. Now, on the matter of, you know, how central banks, whether they should stick to their core mandates, there are two approaches. If you look, for example, at Europe and the European Central Bank, you will see a tendency to feel by the leadership of the bank, Christine Lagarde, that the central bank should be involved in issues of climate change, using whatever policy it can to support the goals of, you know, controlling climate change and all of that. I think that's legitimate. But there is also a danger of a creeping acquisition of mandates where the central bank responds to everything. We actually have that in Nigeria today, where the central bank's development finance functions have become so multiplied that the government has essentially become very lazy. Every problem, they say, oh, central bank set up some development fund for it. And so, you know, you now have a mandate expansion that can become destructive. So I would say that central banks should maintain the core of their functions. If they want to intervene on emerging issues of digitalization or climate change, they should do it at the edge where it intersects with central banking. There have to be other government bodies whose roles are to deal with climate change and with digitalization. That's the way I would look at it. I would be wary of mandate expansion and recommend that it should be done only very, very, in a limited way, in a very limited way. Yeah, yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Kingsley. Now it's the turn of Mohammed, then James, and finally Manuela due to time constraints. So please, Mohammed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Mohammed. I'm from Egypt and I'm an MPA year two student.
You're from Egypt?
Yes. Okay. I am. My question is regarding something you mentioned earlier about moral hazard and how you dealt with it, basically giving banks a peaceful burial. Now, in many cases, banks are obviously by design systemically important, and increasingly a lot of corporations have actually become systemically important too. Maybe like Evergrande in China, for example, could qualify. But my question is, how do you decide whether a bank is systemically important enough to keep it alive, or whether it's one of these that can just be given a peaceful burial? I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
That's a good question. How do you determine the systemic importance of a bank? It's determined based on some very carefully, well understood basis. One is asset size and the base, of the bank's assets. Another is interconnectivity. How interconnected is this particular bank with other banks or other aspects of the financial system, such that if anything were to happen to this bank, we can risk extrapolate what its impact would be. So, deposit base, assets, exposures, for example, is it a bank that has international subsidiaries? Again, this is an element to be taken into consideration in assessing systemic importance. So this is how we do it. Some banks have more exposures, more links, have far more depositors, millions of depositors than others. Some banks, lend to other banks. Again, that is, all part of the linkages. So these are the things that are looked at to determine systemic importance by banking regulators. Yeah, that's, and then moral hazard, yes. I think that's an important thing to look at in any banking system, because when you say that a bank is too big to fail, that's essentially what you mean by systemic importance. When a bank is deemed to be too big to fail, does that impose a moral hazard on the system, making the regulatory framework tolerate something it should not tolerate because a bank has outgrown being controlled? Should any bank be, is anybody indispensable? Or should you say that even though you're systemically important, if we have to take you down, we'll take you down, but we will protect certain interests in that process. So can you develop a living will? It's like the way people write their will when they're alive. When I pass on, my thing should go here, go there, go to mother, father, daughter, wife, all of that. Banks can do that. There's a way that can be done, where a bank can come up with a plan that if anything were to go wrong, this is how it can be decently buried. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James, please.
Hi, Mr. Mogalu. First of all, thank you so much for your great speech and very clarifying questions. I'm James from Brazil. I would like to get your impressions as since you had the experience in the central bank and also as a professor of the current injection of funds from the central banks due to the COVID pandemics, and the so-called expansion of balance sheets. So what do you think about that, first of all, and what are your perspectives for the futures in terms of inflation, are we expecting a new crisis or something like that? Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Now, the matter of COVID, every now and then, like the global financial crisis came around in 2008, you know, COVID is a black swan, you know, it is definitely a black swan in the global system. And when things like that happen, there is no doubt that central banks have every duty, I think, to be creative as they can to help economies to wade through these kinds of crises. Central banks and central bankers saved the world in 2008, 2009. Had it not been for their resoluteness, their courage, their innovation, the world would have been in a very bad place. So therefore, I think there is a place for like what COVID has caused for central bank asset, you know, central bank balance sheet expansion based on a response to what is obviously a global calamity. So now we have tapering going on in the United States. And I think it's for every central bank to determine how it will unwind its balance sheet expansion and create forward guidance on that, such as the Fed has done. And I think the Fed has done a pretty good job of that, you know, but, you know, not all central banks are very good at communicating clearly, you know, and well. Yeah, a lot of central bankers just don't talk. But I think that in today's world, central banking actually calls for enhanced communication skills, because things happen at the speed of light and the speed of sound in the world economy today. And so people, you know, central banking is a confidence game, I always say. And so the ability to maintain confidence, part of it comes from being able to communicate policy and policy paths very clearly. So yes, I think that central banks have been justified in their balance sheet expansion in response to COVID. Yeah, I would not quarrel with that because the threat was existential. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And there's a twofold also element there, I would say, but it's not only the monetary policy of central banks, but fiscal policy from governments, which absolutely also played a huge role in this pandemic, no?
Yeah,
absolutely. A fascinating topic, definitely.
Absolutely, completely, yes.
And finally, Manuela, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for this very interesting presentation. I just have like a really quick question.
What country are you from, Manuela?
Oh, sorry, I'm from Mexico, and okay. I'm also doing the MPA at LSE. So I was just wondering, because in some of like the consequences you mentioned, it was like an increase in confidence and like more investment. But I was just wondering whether you think the reforms had like a similar effect on the depositants and also like SMEs towards like banking system versus, let's say, like mobile application and a fintech system that keeps growing in Africa.
Yeah. No, I think the reforms have had a very, very good effect or good impact on the fintech industry. Like I said, and, you know, our reforms paved the way for the explosive growth of fintech. And Africa is the world's biggest fintech growth market today. And I think that that's a good outcome of these kinds of reforms, certainly. So yes, I would say that. What was the other part of your question?
Whether the reforms in the banking system increase like the confidence for depositants and SMEs to incorporate into the banking.
That's right. Yes, I think so. Because we did a lot of work on financial inclusion. You know, bringing more and more people into the banking system was part of the reforms as well. So we did have an impact on, you know, the expansion of bringing more people into the banks. But the challenge we've had with SMEs in Nigeria, for example, is a, more of a challenge of monetary policy and access to credit. Because inflation has been high and we've had to apply a tight monetary policy for several years, it has restricted the ability of SMEs to access credit. My own solution, now and especially that I'm a politician, is to say that we shouldn't rely too much on a credit-based system, but we need to move more towards a venture capital-based system to support SMEs. And there should be a lot more involvement by the fiscal side of the government. In Nigeria, the fiscal side is very weak. And because of that, that's one of the reasons the central bank carries a lot of burden and a lot of load. In many advanced countries, the federal governments played an important role in the bailout, not just the central banks. In Nigeria, it was only the central bank. The government could not, they did not have the resources to respond to the global financial crisis, and only the central bank could summon it. So yes, while it has had broadly good effects, including in expanding financial inclusion, but for the SMEs, it still has not fundamentally address the problem of access to credit. How that has been done in Nigeria is to use central bank intervention funds to try to support SMEs at single digit interest rates. But the problem, and this is a philosophical issue, is that anytime you want to have the government trying to solve every problem, many people in a country like Nigeria think this is free money. It's my money. They're just, you know, and they will take these loans, and the loans will not necessarily accomplish what they were meant to accomplish. So we need a market that functions in equilibrium without having the central bank to come in to be the one always bailing out SMEs or trying to support SMEs, if you see what I'm saying. Yeah, that means that the macroeconomic environment needs to be fundamentally overhauled. And this will take some time. It's not going to happen overnight. Yeah. Big challenge on SME front. Yeah.
Before we let you go, Kingsley, I have a question that I need to ask. You were talking about bank failure and lender of last resort and moral hazard. Have you thought of having a deposit insurance mechanism? This is something that is actually, you know, quite common at some point in terms of the development of the banking system. Have you thought of that?
No, we do have it in Nigeria. We have the Nigerian Deposit Insurance Corporation. And we work hand in hand with the NDIC to regulate banks. And even on the resolution of the banking crisis, we also collaborated with them. Yeah. The problem with the NDIC is that, you know, they're able to bail out individual depositors, but to a comparatively small amount compared to many depositors, the funds they have in the banks in a country like Nigeria. But the NDIC is a very important component of financial regulation in our country. Yes, and we do have it. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kingsley. I think we could be here spending many more minutes with you.
Thank you.
Such a fascinating discussion. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for sharing with our students and invited to come at another Policy in Practice seminar series. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Kingsley. Let's all give him a
thank you, Adnan. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next time, I hope it will be physical. Yeah.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right. Okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.